Hello and welcome to eLearning Stuff. This is James Clay and today we are conversing about copyright. I have two wonderful guests with me. I have Jane Secker. Hello, Jane.
Hi there, James.
And Chris Morrison.
Hi there.
So, Jane, where are you from and what do you do?
I'm from London School of Economics. I'm the Copyright and Digital Literacy Advisor.
And Chris?
Hi, yes, I'm the Copyright Licensing Compliance Officer at the University of Kent.
Ooh, and are they all compliant?
Is everyone here compliant? No comment.
Okay, on that point. Actually, that's a really good point. Should, you know, we're going to talk about copyright. And maybe what we're going to explain first is what do we mean by the word copyright? Jane?
Oh, right. Okay. Well, do you want a kind of layman's interpretation of copyright? I guess that's probably the best way to go. I mean, it's essentially sort of a set of rights that are conferred on somebody. You don't have to register copyright. Once an original work is created or sort of fixed in some sort of way, I mean, the main thing it gives you the right to do is to kind of protect your work, to prevent other people from copying it, from issuing copies of it to the public and trying to make money out of it. And it's the right also to have your name associated with the work. So those are moral rights. So that's a kind of really in a nutshell. Chris might want to add something to that about how he would interpret copyright.
Yeah, I mean, what I like to say, I mean, because often people sort of say, why is it really important to me as an educator or an education? And I'd say it's the fundamental mechanism that actually relates to any expressions of human creativity, whether that be art or science. So, I mean, copyright's been around for 300 years, and the very first Copyright Act is an act for the encouragement of learning, which is, from the Statute of Anne. So it's basically anything that involves information that is created in some kind of expression is related to copyright. So I think it's quite important that people should be aware of what it is.
I think it might be useful just to kind of, because I always think, find this is, you know, what can be copyrighted in terms of, you know, what counts as creative and in terms of doing that? I mean, if I draw a doodle on my notebook, would that count? As something that I could copyright?
It would have to be something which is sufficiently original. So that's one of the kind of key things. If it really is, I mean, a doodle could be, yes, absolutely. A doodle could be a creative artistic work. But equally, it could be if it was something that was really kind of crude and generic and didn't really show much originality, then maybe not.
But probably nobody would want to copy it then either. But I was thinking also, so obviously, yeah, something like a book or a magazine article, which is quite substantial. But what about a phrase? You know, something like would that be something that you could copyright, or would it be something, you know, or is it because it wouldn't be counted as being creative or original?
I think, well, what you have here, and this often when you have conversations about copyright, it tends to move into other areas of intellectual property. So intellectual property being the overall term for anything where there is a legal right, something that somebody has created out of their own intellectual endeavor. So you started to get into the area of trademarks, where there is protection for, you know, a slogan, but then those have to be registered. So all of these things, and this is probably one of the tricky things when talking about copyright, is that it depends. You know, that's the kind of the standard answer. It depends on the situation. But a phrase could be, if it's sufficiently original and, a substantial piece of work. But generally speaking, when you're talking about copyright things, it's as you say, articles, books, pictures. Those are the things that you know, create the kind of questions and the things you have to deal with.
So one of the things I think, you know, this is the eLearning Stuff podcast. So we're interested in we're interested in digital. And I think, you know, one of the questions that, you know, that I would probably want to ask is, you know, why should academics care about copyright in a digital environment? I suppose, you know, did they not care about it before? Is it something they need to care more about because we're now much more digital? So why should academics care about copyright?
Shall I start? Yeah. Go, I mean, go. I think the key thing here is that it's much, much more visible when you start putting material online. So if you think of the sort of copying that people would have done in the past in a classroom, they might have been they would have been really confined to photocopying material, I think, in a sort of pre-digital age. They might have been writing out parts of a text, you know, but photocopying was pretty much all you could do to be kind of giving out handouts to students. From the sort of late 80s, we've had licenses that allow you to photocopy material. I think the issue with digital is that, you know, what you're doing in the classroom is not necessarily going to be completely private. So you're probably going to have an online space. Some of those obviously do have passwords on them, but some of them don't. You're putting material out online on all sorts of possible platforms that you might encourage students to use. So the kind of the stakes are quite a bit higher if you're getting things wrong, and if you're starting to you know, not understand what you can and can't make available and share, then, you know, potentially you could be putting yourself, your reputation at risk and that of your institution.
Chris. And I would, yeah, so I would add to that that, you know, we're all of us very well, not all of us, but many of us are you know, have now become used to using all these digital technologies to just kind of sharing stuff and grabbing stuff and doing whatever feels natural and feels right. And there is a difference between what you do as a private individual or as a private consumer and what you do as a professional person. And that does, again, call into, you know, there are, you know, the kind of standard issues about private versus professional, about use of digital technologies, and it's just one of those areas where people should just be aware. I don't think they need to be scared of it, but it's just being aware that there is a difference between doing something kind of as a private individual and doing something when you are a representative of an organisation and of a profession, that there's that kind of extra dimension.
That's certainly something I think a lot of people confuse, don't they? The difference between personal and professional. So though I'm more than aware it infringes copyright, because that if I rip a CD onto my iPod or my MP3 player, other MP3 players are available, then yes, I am infringing copyright. But obviously there's an element of, considering I don't share those MP3s, then I'm probably going to be okay. But they did try and take that out. They did try and allow for that, didn't they? Then it went again. But yeah. The example I remember was, you know, some hairdressing lecturers who wanted to play music in the salon. We can go into performance music and write and all those things later. But what they didn't realise was that by using, they couldn't use, because of the music licence they had, ripped MP3s. They had to be the original CDs or original downloaded files, but they couldn't use it. And they didn't understand why. And that, I think that, again, is that confusion between personal and professional. There's things that we do, you know, recording stuff from TV, for home use is very different to recording stuff to be able to then show it in a lecture theatre or a classroom.
Absolutely. And it doesn't really, there certainly are issues around the kind of licenses, the legal agreements that you are subject to as a private consumer and as a as a professional person. So if you're starting to look at the kind of licenses that would be existing around using ripped using music to play in a public performance environment, you're subject to those terms, but then you also, as a private consumer, you click accept to all manner of terms and conditions on various licenses. And I think it's just that feeling that you need to be looking at them in more detail when you're in a professional role. But I don't think you necessarily have to look at every single license. You know, we're not saying that every academic or every person involved in education has to suddenly read through reams and reams of licenses. I think that's kind of why you have licensing people and copyright officers in institutions to help out make sense of some of those things.
Yeah, that's what I was about to say, Chris, that's really kind of where having an expert on hand to help you sort of navigate those licenses and give you some advice and guidance is really important. So I don't think anyone would be expecting teachers and academics to understand every single license. It'd be about having somebody there who could give them some advice. But I think for me, it's about just raising their awareness enough to so that they stop and think before they do something, rather than than kind of ploughing on, creating, you know, all sorts of resources and potentially creating some sort of you know, infringing content that then sort of they present to you to say, well, can you just sort this out? You know, it's far better if they've kind of, before they've started preparing the material, come and asked a couple of questions that means you can point them in the right direction of maybe, you know, licenses that you have or openly licensed content that they could use legitimately.
I think isn't that one of the key issues about staff having an awareness that the moment they start using other people's content, that there's a possibility that they could be infringing copyright, so they need to have a license. But Chris, in terms of the, you know, one of the things that I think people would often get confused by, because you have people say, well, this should be fine, it's for the purpose of education. Mm-hmm. And you know, if you do read the Copyright Act, it does say educational exceptions. So
yes.
Why would I need a license when it's for the purpose of education?
Yes, well, because the Act, the Copyright Designs and Patents Act 1988, as amended, it doesn't have a single blanket exception for anything that happens within education.
So where did that come from? Or is it just people just making it up?
There are educational exceptions which are very important, and we part of, you know, my and Jane and other people in our positions' role is to try to explain to people how it works. So there are certain things you can do. There's one very important one which is called illustration for instruction, which does mean that you are able to make limited copies of certain things as long as it's fair. So we have this idea of fair dealing in the UK. And it's kind of similar, but it's not quite the same as fair use in America.
I think
so there's some confusion
just,
there.
Yeah, I think you may just want to let's just expand on that point there, because it's often one, they don't they, that people, they do a Google search on copyright and they end up with fair use.
Yeah,
but fair use has got no, if my understanding is correctly, has got no standing in UK law because it's a US thing.
Absolutely.
And do you think that's where some of the confusions come about?
Absolutely, yes, it does. So if you look at, a lot of information about copyright on the internet that's in English comes from America. And a lot of the, you know, the kind of wider tensions are related to US legal battles, you know, what Google are doing and Google Books and all these things. So it's understandable that people have an awareness of that and not necessarily of what happens in the UK. So we're based in the UK. We advise on, on UK law. And what you have in this country, and it's also in, you know, it's England and Wales and Scotland, and, you know, it goes right across the board, is that you have a certain, you know, limited list of things that you're allowed to do without the permission of the rights holder in specific circumstances.
That's the fair dealing.
So that's fair dealing. So there'll be illustration for instruction or quotation for either for the terms of, you know, the purposes of criticism and review or otherwise. So those were changed recently. So a couple of years ago, there were some changes to the law, which are very good news. But nevertheless, they haven't widened things out as widely as they are in the US. And they're still quite different across different countries, which can cause some issues. So those are kind of the fundamental reason why people get confused about what you can and what you can't do, which is why, again, there's the value in having people within institutions on hand to try to, you know, explain that and translate those into clear guidance, which is what I hope Jane and I are, again, involved in doing.
Yeah, I think also because, you know, when you're going to rely on an exception, you've got to kind of take this element of judgment, you know, it's always a little bit of a risk and quite difficult sometimes to, without going into quite a lot of specific details about what the content is that somebody wants to use and how they're going to use it and how much of it or what specific part of the content, you know, to advise them whether it is or isn't okay. And sometimes I find that people are sort of almost looking to me to sanction their behaviour, which can put you in quite a difficult position, really, when you're not giving legal advice. You are there just to give advice. But at the end of the day, it is about explaining enough about how the exceptions work and leaving it up to, you know, the individual academic. I had an incident recently of an academic who wanted to use content which you could argue was for the purposes of criticism and review. He was taking some content off various news sites, but he wanted to use it in a video that was going to be recorded and made available via the TED Talk site. And so we had quite a long discussion about exceptions and whether he could rely on them. And in the end, we concluded that he was going to actually try to get a license to use the content that he wanted, because he was concerned he didn't want to get a takedown notice. He wanted his TED Talk, you know, to be watched by many people, and he wanted to be kind of assured that the news site where he was taking the information from were not going to object to what he was doing. So he went down the route of having a license, which, you know, was obviously then taking away that element of risk, which I think, you know, was something that he felt comfortable with.
And it, sometimes I think, isn't it, is that about, it's about risk, isn't it, in terms of doing it. So you may think you have an exception, or you may think you're okay, but actually you can help alleviate that risk by either getting a license or getting permission or using an alternative source.
Absolutely. Yeah. And I think what we try to do is provide a framework around which people could kind of think about that idea of risk. Because often when you get into a conversation about copyright, it can spiral out of control about identifying every inconsistency in the system and all of the things that don't quite make sense and all of the iniquities and all of the things which are difficult. And sometimes the answer is quite straightforward. You know, a lot of the time, I mean, universities, you know, where we work, spend a lot of money on getting licenses for things so you can use them. And so the permission is there already. Similarly, there are some things where, you know, there is a very strong tradition of relying on exceptions, such as people quoting when they're writing a dissertation or a thesis. You know, it's just it's what you do. It's kind of in custom. And luckily, the law has caught up a little bit with custom by having this new updated quotation exception. You know, an example could be if somebody is taking images for research purposes, one of the things that they are expected to do, or whenever you're, you know, kind of using copyright content, is to attribute properly, is to actually say who the rights holder is, who the creator is. And that's a thing that if people don't think about copyright up front, they might go and start amassing all this stuff and thinking, oh, it's okay, I'm doing it for research or education and it's fine. But actually that's a little thing where if you just keep records of who it was, because, you know, when things do go wrong, when someone does object, when there is a potential copyright infringement, that one of the main things that people object to is, well, they didn't say that it was my thing, you know, that kind of respecting people's creativity and by actually saying who it was is one of the major issues. Now, obviously, money comes into it as well. That's another big one. But that's a little thing that if everyone's aware of this kind of attributing, and that matters whether it's an exception, whether it's a kind of a big expensive license, or even something like, you know, like a Creative Commons license, which is free and open, but they all, you know, well, nearly every single Creative Commons license has at its heart that idea of attribution, that you respect other people's, you know, ownership or the authorship, if you like.
Actually, to just bring Jane here, because one of the things I think people get confused with is they assume that if something's licensed under Creative Commons, that it isn't a copyrighted image. Am I right thinking that is a misconception?
No, that is a misconception. I think sometimes I've had people sort of say that Creative Commons is like an alternative to copyright, or is kind of giving away your copyright, which you're not doing at all. You know, you're retaining copyright of your work. What you're doing is you're putting it out under specific terms of an open license. That means under certain conditions. Obviously, the most permissive one is that all you get is credit, so it's an attribution license. But it doesn't mean that you've given away the copyright. I think where potentially that might get a little bit more confusing for people is, obviously, if you do use the most permissive Creative Commons license, then potentially somebody else could use your image to make money out of it. And that might be something that you have a view on. So, you know, I will sometimes say to people, you know, how do you feel about that, your image or your text, your work that you're putting the license on, being somebody else taking it and selling it, and they get the money. And even if they've given you the credit that, you know, it's your photo that's in there, they're making money out of it. And so if people aren't happy with that, that's where, you know, you can get into putting non-commercial licenses on things, or a license that doesn't allow, there's one for no derivatives. There's also a license that means that somebody using your content has to share it under the same sort of licensing terms, the share alike license. But no, I mean, Creative Commons is definitely not about just saying, you know, I'm not interested in copyright at all. You're not releasing your sort of work out there into the public domain. That's for works where copyright has actually expired, you know, where say the author has been dead for more than 70 years. But I think there is still quite a lot of misunderstanding, and I certainly have seen people who say, well, I've just used all Creative Commons licensed images, and they don't necessarily have a list of credits at the end of where those images, who took the, you know, where they've got them from, which I think you should always do.
Yeah, I think having a good audit trail for images is something really useful to have. And I will throw in, but I don't think it's a bit out of scope for this discussion, is also the things like, well, people say, well, actually, you know, I can't find the right image, I'll go and take one, but then don't think about the rights of the individuals within that photograph. So, in other words, the model release form that you often need to have with doing that. Something, you know, so people take photographs of students and then use those, you know, quite freely without thinking about the other legal implications of using, yes, images of people. But that's beyond the scope of this one.
It is, but having said that, it is a question that comes up. So I think it's one of those things where, you know, when we're talking to people about copyright, then things like data protection and privacy and those things come up. So it is sometimes helpful to be able to give people some guidance. And I think, in a way, there's kind of like an overarching ethical thing there. When people ask me about, oh, is it okay to have people pictured in a photo, I said, well, you know, we don't necessarily have the same legal system here as you have, say, in the US, where there's this image rights, you know, part of their law. But nevertheless, you should just ask them, shouldn't you? You know, I think what we like to do is kind of just have common sense, respect, and decency built into it. That's what the law
is
supposed to do.
It's so easy. I mean, when I was running libraries at a college, we wanted photographs of students doing stuff in the library. And somebody went out with a camera and took a load of photographs, but didn't bother to get permission. I said, these are great, but I can't use them, because though the person may have agreed verbally for us to use them for a particular purpose, means I don't want to put them in an image store where someone in the future may use them. So in the end, we created an audit. We went out and retook the photographs, but got model release forms to create a full audit trail, so that we could use the images basically however we wanted, and we got people to sign their rights away accordingly, which sounds rather kind of mean and nasty, but actually made sure that people who didn't want to be photographed weren't, and people who didn't want their image to be used in that way weren't photographed in terms of doing it. Other people were very happy to do it because they wanted to be, you know, they wanted to help us out in terms of doing it. So I think it's, but also, you know, if we couldn't pay them either, is always kind of one of those kind of questions. So let's go back to copyright. And Jane, what are some of the key issues that you're facing in your role at the moment? What's the kind of, you know, the big things that people are talking about?
Well, definitely one of the big things at LSE at the moment, getting a lot of questions from PhD students about copyright issues, particularly because we now have a sort of mandatory online deposit of the thesis. So it goes online into the LSE thesis collection, unless the student has kind of declared that there's something very sensitive in there. And there's a kind of process they have to go through. But the sort of default is that your thesis is accepted for submission in electronic format, and then a version of it will go up online on open access. We get a lot of questions now from PhD students. I have to say, most of the time they're at the point of submission. So it's one of those situations where you're often trying to unpick quite a lot of work that's been going on. Quite a lot of our PhD students are sort of submitting after 3-4 years of work, and they haven't necessarily collected records of where they've got photos from. They haven't necessarily made it really explicit when they're collecting data from people. That data might be photographs, it might be text, you know, that they have permission to reproduce it in their thesis. One of the things I've just produced, I'm very proud of our new little guides for PhD students. It's just a little ASICs guide, but trying to give them out to all new PhD students. The main issue for them is that copyright is not the first thing on their mind. They've just been accepted to study a PhD at the LSE. They're incredibly excited. They're about to, you know, do some research into how to solve the world economic crises or something. They're not going to be thinking about copyright issues. And they're going to start off and do all sorts of field work, and they're still not going to think about copyright. They're going to basically think about it, you know, as an afterthought. And so I want to try and turn that around. And so getting these guides out to everybody at the start of term when they first enrol is hopefully just going to start them thinking about some of these questions early on.
I think similar guides for early career academics might be also useful as well, isn't it? It's kind of hit them when they're first in. Not hit them, that's rather vicious, no, doesn't it? Oh, I'm going to get my copyright hammer and smack you around a bit to make sure you behave. But, you know, but I suppose it's part of induction, isn't it, in terms of organisations. It's not about saying you mustn't do this, you mustn't do that, but it's like with people in your roles, is being able to come to you and say, okay, I know who I need to come to and I need to talk about licensing and copyright.
It's about support, I think, and because I'm similar with Jane, I get quite a lot of questions from PhD students, and I'm also working with colleagues in the library and with our research services team to sort of how do we structure the advice that we give people, researchers, whether it's someone at the PhD level who's at that last minute and has been writing their thesis and is kind of tearing their hair out, just wants to get it right and doesn't want to get in trouble at the last moment. But then when you move into being a researcher and that whole thing about, you know, compliance with the research excellence framework and all of that stuff, which perhaps is slightly out of scope of a discussion about e-learning, but nevertheless, it's trying to get the right help at the right point, at the right level of detail. So it's kind of, it doesn't just become another kind of scary thing or a really difficult thing that we're kind of trying to put things in the right language and we understand the point in the process that people are, and try to kind of head off those kind of difficult conversations by just getting the thing in at the right place.
I tend to find as well that a lot of PhD students are very keen to get their work published, you know, in more traditional sort of like scholarly publications. And so often when they're sort of saying, oh, why do I have to sort this out? You know, these are just images. I explain, well, you know, presumably you are looking to publish your thesis in other ways. You're probably going to write journal articles. You might want a book from it. You do need to understand this is how publishing works. You can't take images. You can't take large amounts of content from somewhere else and reproduce it for publication purposes, whether that's in our repository or whether it's in a book or a journal without getting permission. And once I explain that to them, I think then, you know, it's kind of just realizing that you go through your career, your academic career as a student, and there are differences of what you can do as a student because you're studying. So you have some exceptions that allow you to do things for your private research and study that apply there. When you kind of shift up into being a research student and then get into being actually like a early career researcher, you need to sort of shift up a gear in knowing, you know, building up your knowledge of issues like copyright, but also ethics. And for me, I'm trying to sort of, we started writing this booklet for PhD students and started realizing it had a huge range of overlaps with other topics as well. And actually our research sort of centre have decided that one idea might be to have a series of these booklets, one that looks at, you know, citing and referencing, one that looks at wider questions of ethics and getting, you know, informed consent from people and all those sorts of things. But kind of, you know, it's about having, you know, the right advice, as Chris says, for the sort of level that you're working at. And once you start publishing, creating new knowledge, putting things out there, you know, you've really got to understand about copyright.
I think one of the things, the interesting things you mentioned there, Jane, is this kind of different, because I think this is where people get confused. They see their job as their job, but don't realise that actually they're doing different things. So when they're teaching, when they're lecturing, they're doing something else. But when they're writing for a journal or a publisher, they're no longer that academic lecturer anymore. They're now a writer, and they've both there's terms of copyright in terms of their work, but also in terms of not infringing other people's copyright for stuff they have included in what they want to publish.
Yeah, definitely. I think, you know, you wear many hats when you work in an academic environment, and, you know, lecturers need to be aware that while they might be able to do things for private research and study that they're doing, you know, when they teach, there are other things. When they publish, there are other copyright issues. The other questions that I'm getting increasingly from lecturers are around the recording of their lecture. So that's another area where, you know, we're sort of seeing, well, a kind of potential need to sort of upskill people because of what digital now allows. You know, there's...
Why is that an issue? I mean, so I'm showing something in my lecture. Why does lecture capture make it different?
Well, I am copying it. So I'm not just showing it at that point. I'm potentially, you know, recording it. It may not make a difference. If I'm still using small amounts of it, I probably could rely on an exception. But I think with lots of universities starting to think about things like MOOCs, putting open content up there, putting up podcasts or, you know, lectures, recorded lectures up on their website, then, you know, if there's a lot of third-party content in there, they've copied that material. So when you're in the classroom, although we like to think, oh, technology does, you know, it's enhancing things, it is also creating some extra kind of complications, another layer, because what I do in a classroom when I just show material doesn't require me necessarily. If I show a clip from a TV program, I don't have to copy it. You know, if I have that recorded and I put that up online, then it is being copied and it's being communicated to the public, both of which are you know, potentially going to be infringing copyright if I don't have an exception or a license to let me do that.
Chris, because that's one of the key issues, isn't it, with when we start talking about digital, is that it moves things away from kind of traditional teaching to publication, broadcasting and stuff. Well, I mean, can you think of some examples that people should be aware of as we move into kind of a digital arena?
Yes. I mean, I think the use of images is in teaching, and then those inclusion of those into teaching materials is kind of one of the hot topics, and moving images as well, and use of film. So, I mean, one of the key things that you wouldn't want to do, and what I think most institutions, most copyright advisors say, is that teachers shouldn't be, you know, recording a lecture of, you know, if they're showing large proportions of kind of documentary films or other things. I mean, partly that's largely a quality issue, really. You don't want to be recording a, you know, something that's already in a particular film format, video format, and then you're kind of recording it, the level of degradation on the actual quality of the thing. But the, I think the, you know, the use of lots of images in teaching is widespread and everyone does it. I think that the issue comes about, you know, when you're showing something, say, on a PowerPoint, and then someone records the delivery of the PowerPoint with the lecturer talking over the top of it, and then there's a feeling that perhaps that, you know, does that mean that that's like it is an additional use of it, and therefore should does the exception that might certainly would apply to the just the simple delivery of it in a lecture theatre without the, you know, it being recorded, but then what happens when, you know, that PowerPoint is in your virtual learning environment and then a recording of the lecture with the PowerPoint and the person talking? And that is something that each institution kind of has to make its own mind up, exactly what guidance they give to people when putting together images. And what I'm trying to do here at Kent is talk to individual schools on a case-by-case basis in conjunction with my library colleagues and actually say, well, what kind of stuff is it that you're using? Rather than try to talk in the abstract and say, is it okay to record a lecture where I'm showing images in it? Because it really depends on, yeah, there may be a license available for this stuff. We may be talking about an image database where we've got stuff and we can do that. It may be that people can use Creative Commons licensed images, and then there's no issue if people just kind of want to have generic images of certain things, or it's pictures of, say, architecture. So it's pictures of buildings where you can actually go and find the pictures of the buildings you want on Flickr or somewhere else. Or you could take them yourself, you know, if it's a particular area that you're interested in. And if you are taking them yourself, then you might even want to think about building up a database of images that can be used and used by others and then attributed back to you. And therefore, it helps in that whole kind of thing about openness and sharing. But it's still, you know, I do accept that it is still problematic. And it's one of those things that I think people do get quite anxious about and often raise as an issue as to why recording lectures is difficult, and perhaps they don't want to get involved in it.
I think it's interesting that you talk about images. My my children always say, why are you taking photographs of that, Dad? And it's like, I'm taking it because I'm building up, because I actually do have quite a large Flickr account, link in the show notes, with over 10,000 images, and they all are Creative Commons, non-commercial by attribution. So the thing, but one of the reasons I do take those images is so I can then use them in presentations, and I try and take a wide variety of images so that I've got a huge choice of stuff I can use. But it does sometimes make my children smile when they go, why are you taking a photograph of that?
A cup of coffee or something.
Yeah. Well, actually, to be honest, yeah, the cups of coffee. I always think Twitter is about the coffee. Actually, let's just I just want to pick up a point that Chris made, and Jane, I want to bring you in on this one. Is that you know, both of you have talked about the importance of awareness, the importance of understanding, the importance of knowing what's available, what's not available, the sort of things. You know, the implication is that training is really important. But I can imagine for many academic staff that, and people who are involved in supporting them, that, you know, okay, what shall I be doing this week? Oh, top of my list, attend the copyright training session. You know, it's probably up there with the, oh, look, there's the Data Protection Act training that I need to do, and the how to sit properly at a chair while I'm to type on my typewriter. So how do you, I mean, you both work in institutions where you run training sessions on copyright. How do you encourage people to attend? What sort of advice could you give other people who are trying to encourage people to attend training on copyright?
Okay, well, I'll start on that one. I mean, I do think that there is a lot to be said for embedding copyright into other training sessions. So a dedicated, introduction to copyright workshop is probably only going to ever have limited appeal. It's going to be, you know, people who sort of think, oh, I might be doing something wrong. I certainly wouldn't go down the route myself of trying to sort of make copyright training mandatory in the way that, you know, some other courses like in health and safety are. I think it is about getting the messages. So, for example, when people are learning to use Moodle, our VLE, they get given our Introduction to Copyright guide. They don't get copyright training sort of, you know, as they're learning to use Moodle as such, but they do get subtle messages about doing the right thing in terms of this is the file upload button and these are the sorts of files that you can and can't upload, and if you've got any questions, here's the booklet, you know. It's built into other sessions that are offered in our learning technology department. We also do sessions around finding digital media that you can use, finding images, and kind of really by raising the awareness of collections that we've got that you can use, people will start to ask questions then about, oh, well, does that mean if I just find it through a regular Google image search, I can't necessarily use it? I've also got some really great fortune cookies that we've been giving out to staff at induction sessions. We have a new staff induction for academics, give out the fortune cookies. They've got inside them little messages. Did you know that, that if you want to make scanned readings available, that we have a service at LSE? These kind of really positive messages. But I think it is, you know, for me, about trying to get those messages in as many places as possible, knowing that I will still run my copyright workshops, but, you know, that people should have kind of have heard some of those messages in other sessions that they attend.
What about you, Chris?
Well, yes, no, I completely agree with Jane. It's about trying to embed stuff where it makes sense. One thing I will mention is the Copyright the Card game, which is something that I developed when working with Jane and also Naomi Korn, back, who's a copyright consultant, at the end of 2014. So we got the opportunity through doing some work for Sconnel, who at that point, so that's, you know, colleges and university library organization, wanted to provide some training to people on the recent changes at that stage to copyright law. So it was an idea I'd been kind of thinking about, trying to turn it into a game, and how could you kind of deal with the confusing set of slightly perhaps contradictory rules that make up copyright and licensing in an education or kind of cultural institution. How do you deal with those? So the game is in four rounds. It's available under a Creative Commons license for anyone who wants to download it. And it's been downloaded over 2,500 times now, because it's in Joram, but also it's available from our website. So we'll have the links, I guess, in the podcast notes. But the idea behind that is that you actually get people to really engage with the subject. And so it's not necessary for everyone. I don't think it's the kind of thing that you could reach all 2,000 staff within my institution. They're not all going to have, you know, an hour and a half to 2.5 hours to run through a game in which they're explained copyright from kind of the basics all the way up to kind of the complicated scenarios. But what we see when we do run it is people are actually really engaged with it, because they get into the kind of nuts and bolts at the same time as being able to structure the kind of questions that come up, because it's based on scenarios, but being able to kind of come up with their own answers. And that in a way that when you move into that risk continuum where you don't have that's definitely right and that's definitely wrong, it makes people feel more comfortable, I think, because they're able to kind of work through all the things with all the information that they need on the cards. They can discount the stuff that's not relevant, have a really good conversation amongst groups about what it is that, you know, that is relevant, which licenses might work. So that's one thing that I run regularly at Kenton, and Jane does at LSE as well. And I think we try to encourage people, if they're interested in using that, and obviously talking to us if they want to know, you know, the best way in which to run those sessions. It's certainly made a big difference, and you don't have quite the same number of people falling asleep as used to have in the kind of lecture-based sessions that we used to do.
And I just to add to that, because I mean, although I say, you know, embed it in all sorts of other sessions, it's actually created a real buzz around the copyright training at LSE, which certainly wasn't there before. So every time I run the session, I'm now regularly getting quite large numbers of people. But I mean, by that, you know, in the past, I'd be lucky if I had one or two people signing up to the workshop. You know, I've had 20 people coming along. I've probably trained more people in the last year and a half since I moved over to using the card game than ever, you know, probably in the 12 years previously that I've been running sessions at LSE. Some people have even come twice. So, you know, it's
gluttons for punishment.
But no, I think, you know, it's, I think playing games, and Chris and I have tried out a variety of other games that we've done in sessions that we've run for librarians and for other people. I think it's really important, actually, in an area around like copyright, where, you know, it's a bit of a scary subject. There's elements of risk. There's people sort of feeling, you know, that they don't want to get things wrong. And because they play the game in teams, what I see is some really, really great discussions. I'd love to actually record the discussions they're having when they've got to make decisions. And I think they feel, you know, they feel much freer to be able to talk about the kind of the rights and the wrongs around, you know, what they should or shouldn't do. I mean, obviously, you know, they're not falling asleep, as Chris says. They're not just sitting listening. I'd always tried not to just sort of bore them about copyright for a great length of time, but I think that this is, you know, it's really great fun as the presenter to run Copyright the Card Game. You know, you it totally changes my approach to how I teach. And I do feel that I don't even necessarily need to always know that, you know, the right answer. It's about having a discussion with people in the room and talking about what everybody thinks, you know, should be done.
And I think for me, coming back to this idea of empowerment is really important, I think, because what I'm trying to set up now, what I am setting up at Kent here, is a community of practice amongst my colleagues around copyright. So rather than saying, well, the answer is me to go sit in a room, come up with a training course that covers everything that everyone needs to know, and then I'm going to try and push that out as a mandatory training course to go throughout the organization, that's not going to work. There's only one of me. There's thousands of other people here, and they're not going to have the time or the inclination necessary to listen to me. However, the colleagues that I work with, people in the library and learning technologists, you know, they do. They have these conversations all the time, and I want to empower them to feel confident in what they're saying, because they have huge amounts of knowledge. So they're going to be part of, you know, they've already come to the training courses I run. We're having those conversations, and it kind of makes it more scalable, I think.
I think one of the key issues there, isn't it? It's also about raising awareness. You know, by putting copyright around, is getting people to be aware of those. Someone's typing. That's Jane, actually.
Sorry. You asked me a question.
I know I asked you a question. That's here we are, trying to be a professional and recording a podcast, and she's typing away. No, so you've got a loud keyboard. That's the only
thing. I've got a sensitive microphone.
A very sensitive microphone and a very loud keyboard. Okay, so one of the things that, you know, that actually there, we're talking there about raising awareness. Now, you two have, you've obviously got your own Twitter accounts, which will come to later, but there's another Twitter account that you both do. What's that one about?
Yeah, that's the so we have a website, UK Copyright Literacy. It's a WordPress site, and we have a UK Copyright Lit, I think, is out if you want to follow us on Twitter. It's really, so that's the place to go if you want to get hold of the card game. You can also find out about some of the sort of talks we've been doing recently and some of the research that we did, because actually what I think is really important here is that this sort of work, a lot of it came out of some research that Chris and I did to look at levels of what are called copyright literacy. So how much people know about copyright and working in the library and cultural sort of heritage professions in the UK. And it was an international study that was done in about 14 other countries. And we were kind of looking at how the UK differed, but also sort of finding some really interesting anxieties that librarians particularly felt about this kind of new role that they've had, in a way, not foisted on them, but because librarians sit at this sort of intersection between they're giving access to information to people, but many of the times people who come in actually want to copy the information and take it away with them, and they have all sorts of digital devices with them, it places the librarian in this quite tricky situation sometimes. So our website's really kind of got some of the information about the research we've been doing there, and you know, as well as some of the resources that we've been developing. So it's
and links as well to other places where there is information. So we've got quite a bit of you know, stuff where we think it's helpful. And what we try to do with the Twitter account is point people towards information that would help them in trying to get a handle on, you know, what things mean in copyright and how to communicate it to other people.
Because I think both of us really are interested in, we're interested in copyright, but we're interested in copyright education and how you, as Chris mentioned, the word empowerment. So I think it is, you know, there's been a very negative perception that copyright's just about, you know, acting like some sort of police officer and telling people what they shouldn't be doing. And actually, for me, I've certainly always seen it that if you understand something about copyright, then it's, you know what you can do, and that's got to be a good thing, and that's empowering. But also, as a librarian, you know, you really, because you know you're potentially helping people, you know, come in and get access to, or not even necessarily seeing people, you know, you may need to send them digital files. You've got to understand what you can and can't do and what the licenses that your library might have signed up to allow you to do with that content. So,
Yeah, I mean, when I was running libraries, and I did quite a bit of stuff on copyright and did a few projects on it, one of the things that I always found worked really well when I was doing training was telling people what they can do, you know, providing them with solutions. So rather than say, don't do that, you know, I think training can be very negative. You know, some copyright training can be quite negative. It can be a rule of, you know, a list of rules and do and don'ts. Whereas I think where what my experience was where you inform and advise, but also give people solutions, it actually raised awareness and made people eager to then say, well, actually, I've got this problem. What's my solution? Rather than going, oh, just as another thing I need to ignore.
Yeah,
absolutely. And I would just say, if you tell people, for example, you can do stuff with Creative Commons licenses and this is how it works, and you can use exceptions with attribution, it makes them more aware. You just naturally follow that and with more respect for other people's creative works. And it happened to me, you know, when I first started getting into copyright, as soon as you kind of come aware of what you can do, you think, oh, well, I better do it properly then, because that's just the right thing to do. And now I get all kind of a warm, fuzzy feeling whenever I see an attribution correctly put on a website. It's just a beautiful thing.
Well, let me ask you a question, see if we can get away with this. So imagine that I'm a practitioner who really wants to do more with e-learning, but I'm really want to make sure I do this right. Is there a book I could buy that would help me to kind of make sure that I'm better informed? Would you happen to be aware of any kind of book like that, Jane?
Well, back in 2010, there was actually a book that I wrote called Copyright and E-Learning, A Guide for Practitioners. And coincidentally, it's actually it's a second edition is going to be coming out in a couple of weeks' time that I had the great pleasure of working with Chris on. So this second edition is co-authored. It was sort of becoming quite obvious that, you know, things had changed quite a bit in the last 5 years or so. We'd had quite a lot of changes in the law in the UK in 2014, and Facet, the publisher, sort of suggested I might want to update the book, and I sort of put my head in my hand and said, really? I remember when the first edition, several people said to me, oh, you're very brave offering advice in this kind of e-learning, you know, sphere where it's very difficult. And so yeah, this new book, this new improved sort of souped up version,
don't go too overboard.
is really going to be the you know, I think it's actually a much better book than the first edition. I've tried to write it with quite practical advice about what you can do, obviously bringing in sort of lots of scenarios related to, you know, things like MOOCs, social media, and all the kind of issues around, you know, Facebook and copyright, Twitter, these sorts of things. So, yeah, it's coincidental that you happen to mention
somewhere. Yeah. I mean, I think if we go back, is that thing? I think that's one of the key things, isn't it? Things change. You know, that we have those legislative changes in 2014. I remember that one actually because I used it because one of the things that 2014 Act, and again, correct me if I'm wrong. This is for informational purposes only and should not be construed in any way as advice. was that it allowed for parody.
Yes.
And so the week after the Act came into law, I was at the ULCC Future of Technology and Education conference, and I did a parody of Star Wars. And we, you know, I remember the marketing manager there was a bit saying, "Oh, would we be able to use this?" I said, and I kind of like tried to reassure him by saying, "It's parody. It's fine. It's covered by the new Act." So the one thing ULCC do with those presentations is they video them and then they put them online. So this is not about the purpose of education. This is purely, you know, commercial, putting it out there. And of course, what happened was they got a takedown notice from when they uploaded it to YouTube. But they appealed and they mentioned the new Act and parody, and it got put back. And hopefully, I haven't checked in recently, but I will see if there is, if it's still up, I'll put a link in the show notes.
Yeah, I think it is actually, James. And I think that's important to note actually, because in a lot of cases, if you did put up content as an individual, you know, you might well get a takedown notice. But actually, that's again why understanding copyright could be empowering, because, you know, you could successfully argue that actually what you've done, you know, is whether you did want to take on some larger, you know, 20th Century Fox or something in a copyright lawsuit, it's probably not advisable. But
I would say also, it wasn't the person that took your video down, it was a robot. So, you know, it's just kind of understanding how copyright law might say one thing, and then the tools that you use in order to share things operate on a slightly different basis. And that's one of the big tensions that you have around copyright, that Google operate in one and big technology companies work in a particular way, and they see copyright in a particular way, and the, you know, the kind of 20th century media publishing organizations might see it differently, and there's this tension, and how do you work your way through that? So there is some stuff in the book on that to kind of give people some advice.
Back to the book. And on that note, Jane Secker, Chris Morrison, I'd like to thank you both very much for chatting about copyright. Jane, where can we find you online?
You can find me on Twitter, Jay Secker. And I've got my own blog as well. If you just Google me, and I'm not the Sky TV presenter.
And Chris, where can we find you online?
I'm at C. Bowie Morrison. So Bowie is actually my real middle name. It's not an affectation. So it's C. Bowie Morrison on Twitter. And you can kind of find where else I am by just Googling that or following the links.
Okay, so we'll put lots of links in the show notes. I'm James Clay. You can find me at elearningstuff.net. Thanks for listening.
Well, do you want me to bore you about microphones?
Yeah. It's something to do with the microphone, isn't it? I've joined Spotify. I feel like I've joined the 21st century. It's a revelation.
Well, good for
it's
you.
It's a revelation.
Okay. Well, here's the thing about a microphone. A microphone does not capture the sound absolutely accurately. It cannot. It, by very definition, it's a transducer, so it could, transforms one kind of energy to another. So it takes sound energy, and those they vibrate against some kind of diaphragm or something, which then gets transmitted into electrical energy. So depending on what kind of technology you use, there will be very different frequency responses. And therefore, some microphones are nicer than others for capturing the sound of the human voice. So if you have a dynamic microphone, which is the kind that you would use for live music,
yes,
they're very hard-wearing.
Right.
And they work very well in sort of high-volume rock and roll screaming into it, or kind of anywhere, really. And they're fairly cheap and indestructible. But they don't sound as good as like, a really kind of beautiful studio microphone.
Ah.
Will have a larger diaphragm and will add kind of.
There is some amazing. There's an amazing one in here. I just don't know how it works.
Yeah, because I've got a condenser microphone, which isn't quite the same as a. It cost me about £100.
Right.
That's the one we use in the studio, and it's nice.
Yeah, I'm just looking at this thing, whether I should be using what's in here. Rode. It's a Rode thing.
That's what I've got. That's the one. Yeah. That's
yeah.
What I've got.
Yeah.
They're basically the standard, like you pay £100 and it sounds pretty good, but you know, there are mics out there which cost thousands of pounds.
Do you think I should be using this one? Hang on, I'm gonna take
it. No.
It's gonna be like, I don't know how I'm gonna set it up anyway. So.
No. The kind of cheap microphones that you get on
headsets
are fine. So I can see James's picture.
Yeah, I can too.
I'm still here.
Oh, you're here?
I'm just listening in.
Listening into a conversation about microphones.
Thinking this may be a nice little bit for the end of the podcast.